This is All In. I'm Matt Pelser. Welcome to the Friday Pitch-In. Coming up, we'll hear from a Hoosier volunteer who's helping the wildfire relief effort by, of all things, making crafts for Australian animal relief efforts. Turns out there's a big need for homemade animal rescue products, and many Americans are stepping up, including a group here in Indiana. And later, the Hoosier Environmental Council comments on the recent report that showed that the Indiana Department of Environmental Management budget has shrunk by nearly $35 million in the last decade. But first, we'll kick things off, as we always do, with a look at the week's big state news stories with our very own Indiana Public Broadcasting digital producer, Lauren Chapman. Hi, Lauren.
Hey, how's it going?
Not too bad. So what is going on this week? I learned Hold Harmless Bill is kind of being fast-tracked through the assembly.
Yes. All of the big stuff at the legislature is moving quickly, much to the great chagrin of anybody who has to cover it. and that is especially true for both Hold Harmless and surplus spending. But with Hold Harmless, the bill itself would hold schools and teachers harmless for test scores for 2 years because of the low iLearn scores. Anytime you move to a different test, students have a tendency to freak out a little bit with their scores. And so this bill would hold that harmless for 2 years, allowing school corporations and individual schools to use the state letter grades they received during the 2017-2018 school year. And the Hold Harmless measure also includes high schools. Yeah, even though high schoolers don't take part, take the parts of the iLearn that are used for school accountability. And so the conversation itself has kind of renewed questions around the state's accountability system as a whole and how it should or shouldn't change to reflect how Indiana students learn. I mean, Jennifer McCormick, the state superintendent, has pressed for Indiana to measure school accountability exclusively under the federal system. There's a lot going on with it. And it's also encouraging a conversation about decoupling those scores from it's school and teacher evaluations as a whole, outside of just the 2000 or the next two school years.
So you may have this information, you may not, and you may have just told me. How often is iLearn going to be administered?
It's every year.
It's every single year.
Yeah.
And so does this account for just last year's iLearn, the initial iLearn, or will this possibly work for the next year?
It will work for both last year's school's scores and this coming year's scores.
Okay. And so teachers get a little bit of a break, it sounds like.
Yeah. They're not being held accountable for something that is outside of their control. Like I said, you know, students, it is fairly well known, especially in the state of Indiana, that when you have a new test, student test scores go down by a certain amount. And so they don't want to hold, you know, teachers and schools accountable for something that is entirely outside of their control, at least from the Republicans and the Democrats' perspective.
So my guess is lawmakers will be looking very closely at this year's test results to see if any progress is being made whatsoever.
Yeah.
All right. So what is the budget surplus in Indiana right now?
Yeah. So last July, we discovered that or Indiana discovered that it had collected nearly $300 million more in the last budget than initially expected. So Republicans want to use that money to pay for building projects at state colleges and universities with cash rather than through bonds. They also wanted to do a couple of other separate cash projects. And so Ways and Means Committee Chairman Tim Brown says that paying cash will save the state more than $130 million in interest payments over the next 20 years. So that's what the Republicans are wanting to do with it. But the Democrats want something entirely different. They made it several proposals over the last couple of days to expand pre-K education, to boost teacher pay, to lower prescription drug costs, and to fund more school safety programs. Republicans, and this appears to be the biggest divide in the legislative session between Republicans and Democrats with their priorities. It's how to spend the surplus money. Do you pay cash payments to avoid interest being added to the state's budget, or do you invest in very particular programs that, you know, do demand need? And that divide is obviously going in with the Republican state controlled legislature. Republicans are really driving that so far.
Yeah. So Republicans want to stay in the black, as is characteristic. And Democrats, I think also it sounds like want to stay in the black as well, but maybe not so far. Maybe they say we have all this money, we can use it.
Yeah, I mean, and both of them, I mean, this $300 million is over and above even the surplus that they're just like squirreling away. That has no bearing on the $2.3 billion we have in reserves. This is just extra money that you happen to find. It's like finding $20 in your pocket and you're like, okay, well, do I put this toward, you know, spending a little bit or paying down a little bit of my credit card payment? Or do I take this, you know, and, you know, put it toward fixing a tire on my car?
Mm-hmm.
And that is kind of the bigger divide between these two groups. The Democrats want to pay off the car issue and the Republicans want to pay down the interest on the mortgage.
I wear suits so irregularly. So whenever I do, I try to leave $5 or $10 in the pocket. So the next time I put on the suit, I get a little surprise. So it sounds like
that's incredible.
I don't know if that's a comparison, but anyway. So let's look ahead at the Tobacco 21 initiative that Indiana lawmakers are trying to do.
Yeah.
I mean, I thought that they were just going to.
They didn't have to do anything.
This away because the federal government already did it. But
it's already the law of the land.
It's in the news right now. So what is going on?
Yes. So House Speaker Brian Bosma says that it's important for Indiana to have its own Tobacco 21 laws in place because the federal change still leaves enforcement to the states. And he also says that passing the bill at the state level will help with retail education, basically making sure that everybody's on the same page, that Indiana's laws match what the federal laws are. And that way it's also subject to less change in the future if for some reason the federal laws were, you know, overturned or changed or, you know, what have you. So that's the why.
Well, how is it going? I mean, okay, there doesn't seem to be then much room, and I don't think there would have been anyway, for debate where this is concerned. So at least that will save time because it's already been done at the federal level. Mm-hmm. So it's like, okay, we're going to go off of what they're doing and we're just going to make sure that our laws reflect it.
Yeah, to a certain extent. And so it is going very quickly. But the bill also imposes harsher penalties on retailers who sell smoking or vaping products to anyone under 21.
Mm.
But it eliminates existing fines for anyone underage from possessing those products. And so that's honestly the real point of contention. Everybody else is on board with passing this law, but it's the fines and the punishment that seems to be the trickiest. Grocery and convenience store lobbyist Joey Lackey, during one of the committee hearings, said that it's like saying someone has cocaine if it's legal to have the cocaine, but it's illegal to sell it. And so that's some of the arguments that you're hearing from folks.
Hmm.
So the penalties for retailers who sell smoking or vaping products to minors are significantly toughened by the bill. For instance, the current law says a retailer who commits three such infractions within 6 months faces a $700 fine. But the legislation now would say that three infractions at any time within 3 years means a $1,000 fine and a 30-day retail license suspension.
Wow. Okay. So we're going to write it into the books and it will reflect the federal. And so that's what Indiana has now.
Yeah.
Okay.
Trying to kind of align everything and then make it a little bit tougher.
All right. So what did we hear about ArcelorMittal? First of all, let's go back and find out why ArcelorMittal is under so much scrutiny from IDEM.
Yes. So ArcelorMittal earlier this year had a
Or rather last year, I guess. It was in the fall.
Yeah. Okay. So in August, ArcelorMittal's Burns Harbor facility spilled cyanide and ammonia into a Lake Michigan waterway in August. And so the state has required the plant to send daily test results to the Indiana Department of Environmental Management. But now the agency says that company has been distorting those results. In a letter to ArcelorMittal this week, IDEM said the Northwest Indiana facility has been retesting when test results are higher than they should be, sometimes replacing the higher number with a lower one. Of course, ArcelorMittal denies the accusations. It says it uses certified independent laboratories to analyze the test results and consistently provides accurate data to the state. it's funky, right? Like it's this one particular company that has, you know, had issues in the past with IDEM that, you know, has a certain amount of leeway for what they are allowed to leach into our waterways. And even at that point, it appears that the facility's fudging their numbers a little bit as well.
Okay, we've got a little bit of extra time. Let's talk about 2022 way. Has anything gone out? Any questions via the texting service?
Yes, we have.
First of all, how can people sign up?
How you reach out to us is by texting elections to 73224. And that's how you join the Indiana 2022 way. It's an intimate, more personal way of us asking you a bunch of questions because we want to hear your opinion. You don't want to hear ours. And so we sent out a question on Thursday, which was yesterday. And so the question that we sent out was lawmakers are, of course, discussing student test scores and their value in teacher evaluations and school performance in Indiana. And so what reporting do you guys want to hear from us to better understand this issue? And let us know what questions you already have and we'll follow up. And we've gotten a ton of responses. 33 people responded to us. A lot of really thoughtful questions. And what's really cool is that our education reporter, Jeannie Lindsay, is really excited to start digging into some of the questions that you all brought up for her. So if you really want to be a part of this conversation, if you really want to be a part of our reporting, just shoot us a text message. That's elections to 73224.
And 2022 way, just to sort of remind everybody, is this new initiative that we have going into this very, very big year politically and for other reasons as well.
Mm-hmm. And it's a really good way for us to make sure that we are answering the questions you have. We only have a certain amount of experience. We only have a certain amount of perspective, and we want to be able to answer questions that are outside of our own perspectives as well. So by joining, you help make us a little bit better.
If you're a regular listener to public radio stations, you've heard this a million times. You are the public in public radio.
Yes.
When she is not here, she is back in the web cave doing the real work. Indiana Public Broadcasting digital producer Lauren Chapman. And I'm sad to say that you're going to be going away for a couple months.
Yes. I'm letting our delightful and slightly crotchety State House reporter Brandon Smith.
You said it, not me.
Take over for the Friday Pitch-In. He is the expert at the State House. If you need to know anything that goes on in those walls, he's the person to know.
He is steeped in it. I'm glad that Brandon is stepping into this slot while the General Assembly's in session, but I do look forward to your return in the spring, and I expect flowers in your hair to celebrate.
Oh, if not flowers, I'll definitely have baseball paraphernalia of some sort.
There we go. Thank you, Lauren. Up next, we'll hear from Sylvia Smith, a volunteer helping the wildlife rescue effort in Australia in the wake of the deadly wildfires there. What she and other Hoosiers are doing to help out may surprise you and may very well inspire you to help out as well. I'm Matt Pelser. We're back in 90 seconds. This is All In. This is All In. I'm Matt Pelser. Before we get back to the show, I want to mention our show yesterday. Dozens of Indiana's jails are overcrowded. A statewide group assembled to study the issue found no easy solutions. But the collaboration has left some hopeful that change is coming. We talked to a comprehensive panel of lawmakers, state officials, an Indiana Supreme Court justice, and a county sheriff who sees the effects of overcrowding firsthand. You can find that and all our past shows on our podcast feed. And be sure to subscribe so you always know what we're talking about. Just search All In and look for our blue and black logo. Lately, we've been hearing a lot about the devastating wildfires in Australia. The impact on the people there is great, but the continent's unique wildlife have been getting a lot of attention as well. You may have seen videos on social media of volunteers giving water to koalas who may have been injured or displaced by the wildfires. For animal lovers around the world, the news has been tough to take. But some have been spurred to action, including American Rescue Crafters Connect, who has a unique role in assisting some of the wildlife volunteers in Australia. Joining me is a local volunteer for the Indiana chapter of American Rescue Crafters Connect, Sylvia Smith. Good afternoon.
Hi, thanks so much for having me.
So we've seen a lot of photos and video come out of Australia. There are numerous graphics that illustrate just the scale of these wildfires, thousands of homes and buildings destroyed. A huge impact on the population, of course, particularly the rural population of Australia. But anybody who knows anything about Australia knows that there is a diversity of wildlife that can't be found anywhere else in the world.
Absolutely.
First of all, from what you know, how bad is it? What's happening?
Well, as most everyone has heard at this point, these wildfires are raging throughout the continent of Australia. Wildfires are a natural part of forest ecology, and the fires raging in Australia are beyond what many scientists have considered normal or expected. Australia has been in drought for years, and this is Australia's summer season, so they are used to having a fire season. But the current climate conditions have allowed for just soaring average temperatures of 105 degrees Fahrenheit. Their winds are gusting at 50 plus miles an hour in some places, and they've had little to no rain. So because of this, our estimates were originally showing that there were roughly 12 million acres squared that had burned. But while some of the most current estimates are now talking 32,000 square miles, which is about 20 million acres that has either burned or is currently on fire. And that's actually about the size of the state of Indiana. So
imagine the entire state of Indiana, everything you know in Indiana, on fire.
Yep. Either on fire or has burned.
Or has burned.
Yeah.
And so from what you know, and again, you're just a volunteer helping out, from what you know, how many animals, let's just look at the very dark number. How many animals have been killed as an estimate?
So initially they were thinking roughly half a billion. Mm.
Tell me that number went down.
It did not. An individual from the University of Sydney in Australia, he's an ecologist by the name of Chris Dickman, actually estimated as of either the 7th or 8th of January that they are up to about a billion animals have passed either because of the fires directly or indirectly.
Wow. You're an animal lover, right?
Absolutely.
And so what is that news like to take for you?
It's hard. Because one thing that a lot of people aren't thinking about is it's not just the cute kangaroos and koalas. It's the possums and it's the birds and it's the bats and it's the insects. Some of those are pollinators, like bats pollinate. So this isn't just devastating for the animals. It's devastating for the entire agricultural structure of Australia.
And we're talking about a lot of animals that aren't seen anywhere else in the world just because of the way evolution works. You know, Australia is isolated. It's its own island. And so the way animals have evolved there makes them unique from many other animals in the world, especially when it comes to their population of marsupials.
Correct. So like a possum is considered a marsupial, which...
And we have possums here.
Yep, absolutely. We have those here in Indiana. They're actually great for our environment and they eat ticks. But in Australia, animals, marsupials such as koalas or kangaroos, those are native to Australia and the islands surrounding. And they're found nowhere else in the world save for zoos and other sanctuaries.
So what is your organization or the organization that you're involved with, American Rescue Crafters Connect? What are they doing to help out?
Yeah. So in Australia, an animal rescue collective guild began partnering with local sanctuaries who said that they needed certain materials, certain products to help care for and save these animals. And this is something that they've been doing just like we have animal sanctuaries here in Indiana for injured raccoons. But because of the extent of the damage, these sanctuaries have just been overrun trying to save these animals. So this guild started in Australia, which Americans found out about, and they created their own group to try to help. And then from there, a Hoosier by the name of Angie Turnpaw stepped up and created an Indiana chapter. And what we do is we sew or crochet or knit a variety of items that are used to help care for these injured, orphaned, burnt animals.
So the, foundation of these organizations have just sort of only come up in the last few weeks? Or did American Rescue Crafters Connect exist before and did other things perhaps?
My understanding is that these groups in Australia have existed for a while, just mm-hmm. as part of caring for the animals there. But my understanding is that the Americans stepping up, this group, I believe, was created in April, and the fire started in September. So it was, there were a handful of people in April that were helping with just what Australia was going through last year. Mm. And it has grown exponentially since September.
So what are the kinds of things that are needed? I mean, I guess I think volunteers are needed. Of course, you want people there to take care of these animals. But you're talking about making items and sending them there. And when I hear something like crafters are coming together, I mean, we're not talking about knitting socks for koalas or anything like that. And forgive the tone there, but what are we talking about doing and what's it helping?
Yeah, I mean, I can't go over there and fight fires. It's not a skill I have, but I can sew. And so what many of us are doing is we are creating what we call Joey pouches. And they're just exactly what that sounds like. It's just a little pouch, fabric on the front, fabric on the back that's sewn together, and an animal can sit inside of it, almost like a little sleeping bag. And, you know, we use specific fabrics to lessen how much they stick if there are open burn wounds. And we're making pouches, we're making bird and rodent nests. Mm. Those, many people are crocheting those nests together. We have hanging pouches that we're making. So those really just look like a purse, an open bag that someone might carry that you can put a little kangaroo or wallaby in.
And anyone who knows anything about the biology of marsupials knows that when they're very young, they live in a pouch.
Yep.
Exactly. And is that the thought behind this, is to sort of mimic that?
Absolutely. When, like a kangaroo, for example, when they are born, they're not quite done gestating, actually. So they finish that initial development within their mom's pouch. So there's only so much fabric can do that a natural mother kangaroo's pouch actually does. Mm. But these pouches help them feel safe and tight, almost like swaddling a baby. It's that same kind of concept. It's something that helps them feel safe. And if they've lost their parents, especially for the little ones, it's something little that we can do to hopefully make a difference.
And you say they're specific on the patterns and the fabrics and things like that. Are they so specific on the fabrics that they're difficult to come by? Are these things that you can't find at the local store?
Well, the patterns were put together by Piccolo Studio. And so those have been made available in Google Drives for all of us around the world. I mean, there's people in the UK getting on board with this. They've got their own chapter. So we're all using the same patterns created by this studio of tried and true structures that will hopefully withstand animals chewing on them and sleeping in them. But the fabric is actually expensive for Australians to purchase. Mm. So for them, it may be challenging to come by some of these fabrics. But for us here in America, we tend to have a little bit easier access to it, although we have the shipping challenge that Australians don't have. Mm. But we can use things like a cotton polyester mix, like a typical shirt might be. But we want to avoid polyester or other man-made products for against the animal's fur or skin. Mm-hmm. And that's just a variety of reasons. But the main thing is that's not what the wildlife sanctuaries want to use. And they're the ones doing the work. So we will make them what it is that is going to work for them and their animals.
And what are they requesting? What are they requesting? I mean, I guess natural fabrics is probably what they're requesting, but what specifically?
Preferably 100% cotton or flannel or flannelette. So those natural fibers. For people who are crocheting or knitting, we can use acrylic yarn. But once again, that's for outer pieces that aren't coming in contact with an animal's skin, fur, or feathers. So the insides need to be lined with a more natural fiber, or they're sewing, knitting, crocheting with bamboo or hemp fiber or wool fibers as well.
And so these are then being put together here. And then what's the next step, I guess? Is there like a timeline, a schedule that you're looking at where like, hey, we need this many of this, and then this is our deadline. We're going to package it up and we're going to send it off on this day. Are you working under some kind of a deadline?
So there are, my understanding, 7 hubs throughout the United States and a variety of GoFundMe accounts and PayPal accounts set up to help those 7 women ship whatever their region can get them over to Australia because shipping is so expensive. And we don't want to just be shipping small boxes with only a handful of items. We want to make sure we are utilizing our shipping abilities the best we can.
Maximizing them.
Absolutely. So for us in Indiana, I believe our coordinator is shooting for sometime at the end of January in a few weeks to get the first batch of what Hoosiers make to the hub in Illinois. So the hub for the Midwest is actually pretty close to us. We are lucky in that regard. So we have a whole network going throughout the state of people in multiple counties that are either making things or collecting donations and then dispersing them to people who are able to do the creating. And then we're all working together to meet in different spots and have drop-offs at different places and ultimately get all of those items packaged together and over to our Illinois hub before they're sent off.
I guess with regard to the jobs that you're doing and that certain people are doing, obviously some people are making crafts, some people are coordinating sort of the logistics and things mm-hmm. like that. Of the things that are being done, where is the biggest need? Is the biggest need simply producing these items, or is it elsewhere?
Oh, goodness. There's so much need.
And I know that you're just a volunteer, yeah. So you may not be close enough to it to be able to answer that question. But from where you sit, what would be the answer?
I mean, we have only a few people who are still in need of physical fabric. They're able to sew, but they don't have the money to go out and buy a bunch of fabric, or they just don't have these types of natural fibers laying around their house to cut up and assemble into something new. So there are a handful of people like that throughout the state that are ready to make things and they just don't have the materials. So others, like myself, are working together to try to collect donations in our local communities and then distribute that excess fabric, because I can only sew so much. I only have so much time. So my excess fabric is going to go to someone, say, in Plainfield who has the time to sew, but she doesn't have any fabric. So we have roughly 300 people throughout the state that are working to either gather these supplies or do the knitting, the crocheting, and the sewing to assemble these items.
So per the specs that they have sent down, mm-hmm. are you allowed to use anything, or are they requesting new fabrics? Do you find yourself cannibalizing old T-shirts?
They have actually requested that we use used fabrics as much as is possible. A lot of us are going to local reuse stores such as Goodwill and seeing what kinds of good condition cotton bed sheets or flannel bed sheets we can find, because those are large pieces of fabric that we can make some big items like for kangaroos. And that way we are not causing excess stress on the environment, because fabric is very expensive, uses a lot of water to produce. So we're trying to reuse what fabric we can. So yes, my husband did just clean out his closet this morning.
So we may have some interesting graphic tees on the backs of kangaroos before too long.
Yes, absolutely.
And so how busy have you been? What have you made so far?
Well, my printer was giving me some trouble.
Using the printer to kind of print out the patterns?
Absolutely. Yep. Okay. So I can go into a Google Drive, print off all the patterns, print these, tape them together, and then I trace it out on the fabric. So I was up late last night tracing out a bunch of different sized Joey pouches from extra, extra small up to medium, and getting those liners ready to go and getting those outside pieces ready to go so that I can just sew them up in one batch.
And so if anyone else wants to get involved somehow, if you're hearing this and you're like, I can sew, I can crochet, I can knit, where do they want to look to be able to find these patterns and these specs that they need so badly in Australia?
So here in Indiana, the Facebook page, it's a long one, is Hoosiers Helping American Rescue Crafters Connect. Mm. And that is where we can find all of those specs for the specific types of fabrics to use, whether you can use them on inside or outside of these pouches and creations, all of the patterns for everything from pouches to bat wraps to animal sweaters to the nests. So we've got all of that up on the Facebook page. And then our Facebook page, we've actually branched out and our coordinators have created two separate pages that we're using specifically for coordination of shipping and moving items north and south throughout the state.
Okay, so Hoosiers Helping American Rescue Crafters Connect.
Yep.
And you can look at the specs and the patterns and you can possibly make a difference yourself.
Absolutely. And, you know, if you have issues, you have concerns, or you just want to donate some fabric because you're unable to do any of the actual sewing or crocheting, you can still join the group. We have people throughout the state who are looking to collect donations of that fabric and of that yarn so that we can network that and get that out to people who can assemble those into the products that are needed overseas.
She's a local volunteer for American Rescue Crafters Connect, Sylvia Smith. Thanks so much for coming on.
Thanks so much for having us.
Up next, a recent report from the Environmental Integrity Project claims the Indiana Department of Environmental Management has seen its budget shrink by almost $35 million in the last 10 years. We'll bring in two representatives from the Hoosier Environmental Council to comment on what that means for the agency. I'm Matt Pelser. Back in 90 seconds, this is All In. This is All In. I'm Matt Pelser. Over the last decade, funding for the Indiana Department of Environmental Management declined by nearly $35 million, according to a report from the Environmental Integrity Project. State Budget Director Zach Jackson has cited the decrease as a result of fewer waste permits being issued, adding that, quote, Hoosiers are emitting fewer pollutants as they become more environmentally conscious. Here for some context and commentary are a couple representatives from the nonprofit Hoosier Environmental Council, Senior Policy Director Tim Maloney. Good afternoon, Tim.
Good afternoon.
And Environmental Health Director Indra Frank. Hi, Indra.
Hey, Matt.
First of all, for listeners who might not know, Indra, what is the Hoosier Environmental Council? What do you do?
The Hoosier Environmental Council has been working on Indiana environmental issues since 1983. We are Indiana's largest environmental not-for-profit organization. We keep an eye on bills going through the State House. We work on making Indiana more sustainable and having a healthier environment.
And Tim, can you then also explain IDEM, the Indiana Department of Environmental Management? What do they do?
IDEM is the state agency charged with enforcing our environmental laws, both the federal laws like Clean Air Act, Clean Water Act, and also Indiana's environmental laws. So they're responsible for making sure that our air is healthy to breathe and our water is safe to drink and our land is free of contaminants. And as part of that, they issue permits for dischargers to who release pollution to the air, water, or land.
I've heard them also described as an EPA for Indiana. So where does the EPA fall short and the IDEM has to take over? Or why do we need IDEM in addition to EPA?
Well, under the structure of most federal environmental laws, the implementation of those laws are delegated to the states. And that's why states have their own independent environmental agencies, and that's the case in Indiana, where the EPA has delegated implementation of the major federal environmental laws like the Clean Air Act, Clean Water Act to the state of Indiana. And then Indiana may supplement those federal laws with its own state-specific statutes, and so we need an agency to administer and implement and enforce those laws as well.
So has IDEM succeeded in that? Are they robust enough in order to fulfill that mission?
Well, in our view, they are not robust enough, and that situation has been exacerbated by an ongoing reduction in their funding for many years as has been indicated by the Environmental Integrity Project report, and to the point where those continuing reductions, even past the time when we had the American financial crisis, the recession, and of course, budget cuts were, you know, appropriate at that time, but those cuts have continued even as our economy has recovered and our economy has grown and state spending has grown. We've still seen our state agencies starved for funding, and that affects their ability to do their job.
So this report then, this loss of nearly $35 million, accounts for that, the fact that the funding was sort of dropped in the wake of the Great Recession and sort of never recovered, and in addition to that, other cuts have been made?
Yes. After cuts were made during the recession, pre-recession levels were not restored, and instead, cuts continued during every budget cycle. The state government, since the days of Governor Daniels, has enforced reversions on state agencies and limited their spending, and that serves over time to reduce the base budgets for the agency.
Indra, this news that over the last 10 years, the budget for IDEM has decreased by nearly $35 million, what has that meant for the agency in recent years? What does this decrease in funding look like? What are we getting or not getting as a result?
Well, keep in mind, IDEM provides all of the personnel that ensure that we have clean air and clean water, and that when pollution does happen, it gets cleaned up. So having less in the way of resources and a lower budget means that we have fewer inspectors, fewer permit writers, fewer environmental scientists, fewer environmental engineers who are taking care of that work. During Governor Daniels' time, the target staffing for the environmental agency was about 900 staff. We're currently running at about 800 in our environmental agency. And that affects a lot of the programs at the agency. One example would be the drinking water section. So part of our Department of Environmental Management's mission is to ensure the safety of drinking water for Hoosiers. There are more than 4,000 public drinking water systems in Indiana. That's because a public drinking water system can be anything from our towns and cities having drinking water systems to small rural facilities like a rural church or a rural school that has its own well. So we have more than 4,000 of those public drinking water systems. IDEM had 62 staff members in their drinking water section in 2005. As of 2019, last time we checked, it was 48 staff members. And that has resulted in a drop of 43% in the number of technical assistance visits that the IDEM staff have been able to provide to those drinking water systems. That's been most important for the small rural systems that can't afford their own technical staff.
Tim, if the budget stays at what you consider this to be, I guess, a survival level, what could that mean for the agency in the future?
Well, I think it means a couple of things. And Indra talked about one of the impacts that we've seen happening right now. Another one has been in the agency's cleanup program for contaminated waste sites, what's known as the state cleanup program. And that program has been hampered by a lack of funding and staffing, the project managers who oversee these cleanups. And what we've seen in over the past several years is that as the number of new sites added to that program, new sites identified and needing cleanup added to the program, are exceeding the sites that get cleaned up and the case file is closed out because the site has been cleaned up. So their workload is growing. And so we can anticipate that continuing into the future as more contaminated sites are identified and the agency doesn't have the ability to keep up with it. And the agency has even conceded that they can't keep up with billing responsible parties to recover those costs. The law allows them to recover the costs of cleanup where the responsible party is still in business and has resources. So they're not even keeping up with the billing. And so that harms the revenue from the cost recovery. So that's another specific example of what's happening. And then long term, it really affects the agency's ability to recruit and retain qualified, dedicated people if their salaries are not competitive with the private sector, and so they lose people once the agency trains them in environmental policy and regulation, and then they're lost to the private sector because it's a more lucrative position. That certainly should not be the role of state government, and it jeopardizes having a real career force there that knows what they're doing. They're well trained and they're committed to the job. And I think, you know, we all believe there are a lot of dedicated, committed people at the Department of Environmental Management who want to do the right thing, but we're just not giving them the tools to do that.
It's also hard for them to stay on when the case workload increases, as Tim pointed out.
Indra, we heard the statement at the top of the show from State Budget Director Zach Johnson that among the reasons for this decrease is that fewer waste permits are being issued. How much do these permits factor into the IDEM budget?
Well, I'll get started and then hand off to Tim. So the Indiana Department of Environmental Management has three sources of revenue. One are grants that they get from the federal government. Another are the permit fees that you just referred to. So if they're writing a permit for a water discharge or for an air emission, they get to charge a permit fee. And then the third are allocations from the Indiana General Fund. These are allocations made out of the state budget that comes from the taxes and that we all pay. That general fund allocation has actually dropped more relative to some of their other funding sources. So over the past decade, overall, the department is down about 20%, but the general fund allocation is down 34% compared to a decade ago.
I think that's a key point is those cuts in the general fund. And then if you look at the history over time in terms of the revenue coming in from those permit fees, such as waste disposal permit fees, that revenue has gone up and down and not been on any kind of a steady downward level. And actually for the biennial budget prior to the current one, the dedicated revenue in IDEM's budget was almost $10 million a year greater than the prior biennium. So I think we'd want to have that response explained to us why that's what they're attributing the decline to, because that's not the record that we've seen.
That was going to be my next question. Is that a reasonable explanation in your view, just the fact that they're issuing fewer waste permits?
Just looking at the numbers, I don't think that doesn't account for the difference. And clearly, Indra's also demonstrated the rather substantial cut in general funds. The dedicated revenue that IDEM uses as part of their revenue stream is not just waste permits. It's from permits to release pollutants to the air and to the water. You know, we still have a lot of manufacturers and municipalities and power plants getting permits and paying for those permits. So this notion that because there are fewer waste permit fees is the reason for IDEM's decline in funding, it just doesn't reflect the numbers or what's happening on the ground.
Indra, what else is there to say about permits?
So as I mentioned, the permit fees are one source of the revenue for the Department of Environmental Management, and it's an important one. The majority of the permit fees had not changed since 1994. So I guess one of the reasons that maybe that source of funding had dropped was just lost due to inflation. Last year, the legislature took up that issue, the fact that those permit fees hadn't changed in such a long time, and passed a law that allows IDEM now to do some updates to their permit fees. But the new law also puts constraints on how much they can increase the permit fees, so that, in fact, if they implement that law fully, it will really only keep them at about the 2018 funding level, and 2018 is down about 20% relative to a decade prior.
The arguments that we often hear against environmental regulation is that it stifles business, it stifles growth, and that sort of thing. What is your counter argument to that?
We think it's the exact opposite, and that a healthy environment is a requirement for a healthy economy. And in fact, if you're not able to get contaminated waste sites cleaned up, or your waterways, or are not suitable for water-based recreation, swimming and boating and fishing, or people can't go outdoors because the air, we have ozone alerts or particulate alerts. That's not benefiting your economy. That's hurting your economy. And it also hurts the ability of Indiana to attract the kind of, you know, high-paying tech jobs and that we want to attract and attract the talent, the talented young people to work at those jobs because they're looking for places with a great quality of life, which includes outdoor spaces to recreate, places to bike or hike or go paddling or go picnicking with your family. Those are all essential elements of a comprehensive economic development program. So the idea that we can sacrifice environmental protection to benefit the economy is a false idea.
Anything to add, Indra?
Oh, just another example of a way environmental damage hurts us economically would be the situations we've had where sources of drinking water have been contaminated. There's a well field here in Indianapolis where some of the wells had to be shut down because there was contamination in the groundwater. The same has been the case in Franklin. We've seen damage to drinking water sources up at Lake Michigan because of spills and exceedances as well. That hurts the local municipal drinking water system. They're having to do additional treatment to make that water safe for consumption.
Tim, the economy has recovered. It's doing quite well now. Are there perhaps more hidden reasons for this decrease in funding for IDEM over the last 10 years? How political is this?
Politics is part of it. The notion that, you know, we're a low regulation, business-friendly state, small government state, you know, is kind of a tradition in Indiana. But the perils of that policy, if you think that that means, therefore, we have to cut essential environmental services like what the Department of Environmental Management does in terms of protecting our air and water and land, then again, it's a false premise that that leads to a better quality of life if we're not investing the resources necessary to take care of those aspects of our environment that really help us survive.
Indra.
The budget for the state, of course, is set by our legislature and by the governor. We of course, can't speak for them, but our elected officials are responsive to their voters. And so, you know, voters always have the option of letting their elected officials know what their own personal preferences and priorities are.
Tim, given that we're not yet in a budget year, that's next year, are we not likely to see change on this perhaps until next year?
I think it's unlikely to happen, but it could happen. The House of Representatives right now is considering a bill to reopen the budget very narrowly to adjust some capital appropriations. And given that we have a state surplus that's well above what's defined as the prudent surplus range, to us it would make sense to help to start redressing that shortfall in IDEM funding. But it's more likely that it's going to be taken up next session during a budget cycle. But in our view, you know, there's funds that could be applied to help start making up that deficit and doing better at investing in our environment and our quality of life.
The point that Tim was making helps put this drop in IDEM funding in some perspective, right? So the agency has lost 20% of its funding relative to a decade ago. During that same period of time, we've seen a growth in overall Indiana government spending, and we've seen growth in the budget reserve. Indiana has, if I understand correctly, more than $2 billion in reserve right now.
From the nonprofit Hoosier Environmental Council, Senior Policy Director Tim Maloney, thanks for your time.
Thank you, Matt.
And Environmental Health Director Indra Frank, thank you.
It's good to be with you.
Our producers are Drew Dodlin and Maggie Galon. Scott Cameron's our managing editor. Our show is engineered by Adam Gross. If you'd like a podcast of this show or any past show, you can find it anywhere you get your podcasts and be sure to subscribe so you always know what we're up to. Join us Monday when we'll look at the resurgence of meth in Indiana. Some experts show meth has surpassed opiates in popularity. We'll talk to law enforcement and medical experts to find out why. In the meantime, find us on Twitter and Facebook at All In Indiana. I'm Matt Pelser. Thanks for listening. Have a great weekend. This is All In.